Okay, our final speaker is Dr. Bill Friedman, professor of biology at Dalhousie. His research has examined environmental effects of a broad range of industrial activities on biodiversity and ecosystem function. He's produced over 100 refereed publications and several textbooks on ecology and environmental science, which are written from a Canadian perspective. He's also served on the National Board of Directors of the Nature Conservancy of Canada. He has received awards from the Canadian Geographic Society and from the Canadian Council of University Biology Chairs for his achievements in raising environmental awareness. Today he'll be speaking about ecological sustainability.
Does it work? Thank you for that introduction. It was most generous, but then I did write it. Compared to the other presentations you've had today, mine's going to be kind of lightweight. I'm not going to show a lot of data. I'm going to be talking about concepts. I hope I don't insult anybody's intelligence, but I think it's important for us to maintain the context of environmental science and environmental studies. We've heard relatively specialized presentations today, all of them terrific, and I learned something from all of them, and I'm better as a result, and I know you guys are as well. But I think we always have to maintain a certain context about environmental conditions on the planet, that sets the stage for our environmentalism, our concern about environmental conditions. Now, part of that context is, of course, the fact that the thing that makes Earth and its biosphere so singular is that it exists at all. As far as we know, there's no other place in the universe that supports life and ecosystems. There are, by one measure, one estimate, some 10 to the 20 stars in the universe, all of which probably have solar systems, planets orbiting around them, and probably there's life elsewhere, but we don't actually know that. We only know for a fact that it exists in one particular place, and it's common in classes in environmental science to show a picture of Earth from space, and the purpose of doing that is to reinforce the notion that almost everything that we need as humans and almost everything that life as we know it needs in general in order to exist is limited to the resources that are presently on our own isolated planet, with one key exception, of course, and that's sunlight in its many manifestations, which is something that we import. But everything else is essentially limited to planet Earth. This image shows Earth. It's this pale blue dot. This may be the furthest away image, discernible image of Earth that exists. It was taken from Voyager 1 more than a decade ago at a distance of 6 billion kilometers from the planet. Now, Voyager 1 has since gone on to hugely greater distances, recently said, in fact, to have exited the solar system. But this image represents Earth photographed as a discernible entity from the farthest probable distance. The purpose of a photograph of that is to show the utter isolation and also smallness of the world that we know about. It also reinforces the idea that although the words vary and unique are often used in foolish ways to exaggerate situations, I think they do apply to the fact that Earth is very unique in the sense that it does sustain a biosphere, life and ecosystems, and that makes the planet rather special. Now, in classes in environmental science, we commonly approach the subject matter as representing a type of crisis, in which our own species is threatened and our global enterprise, while at the same time all of the other species with which we cohabit the biosphere are also threatened. when I teach environmental science and when I write about it and think about it, too, I often aggregate the subject matter, which is complex, into three major subject areas. And the first is population-related issues, and the second is resource-related issues, and the third is a catch-all category that involves various kinds of environmental and ecological damages. And I learned that subdivision from the first important book, I think, in environmental science that was published, I think in 1970, by Paul Ehrlich, his wife, and a colleague, Holmgren, at Stanford University. In that book, they titled Eco-Science, and they called it Population, Resources, and Environment. I'm going to quickly go through each of those subject matters just as an overview of what we know about this environmental crisis. And I also like to use this Larson cartoon to talk about the environmental crisis and what's causing it to occur. The cartoon is based, I suppose, on one of the two creation myths that are summarized in Genesis, the first book of the Abrahamic Bible. And the cartoon shows Earth on, the sixth day of creation, when everything had been created and set forth, and the world was perfect, except humans hadn't been introduced yet, and God was in heaven. She was thinking about this and had humans in a bottle and was wondering, do I or don't I? And then, although we think of God as being infallible in all ways, a little mistake was made. The bottle containing humans slipped from her fingers, descended from the biosphere, and humans were unleashed. The consequences that have resulted from this are commonly viewed in environmental science as representing a kind of a crisis related to an extremely large abundance of humans, rapid depletion and other damages to natural resources, and then various other kinds of environmental damages, including pollution and degradation of biodiversity values. So let's first consider the population-related aspect of the environmental crisis. Some 10,000 or so years ago, right at the end of the late Neolithic, when humans first started the inklings of agricultural practices, when we first started to foster the productivity of a few crops occurring initially in the Tigris and Euphrates valley of Mesopotamia, and probably approximately simultaneously in southern China, the first agricultural practices started. And at that time, where previously human economies were totally based on foraging and hunting wild resources, at that time our population might have been some 5 to 10 million people globally. And in many respects, we can consider that to be a kind of a baseline for the human population in a relatively primeval condition before we really started to accelerate the process of cultural evolution, which over the subsequent millennia has hugely empowered us to have our will with the biosphere. And today there are, as you know, some 7 billion people alive. I think the present tally would be about 7.1 billion. So that's a huge increase in our abundance, and in many respects, we may already have overpopulated the planet, in the sense that our global environmental footprint may be already exceeding biocapacity. Of course, our population is continuing to grow. The rate of growth has decelerated greatly in over the last several decades, but it's likely that by the middle of the present century, there'll be about 10 billion people on the planet. Canada, by the way, would have 500 years ago supported an original population of a few hundred thousand people. Today, there are some 34 million Canadians. Our population is growing at about 1.1% per year, and that means that it'll double in about another 63 years if that sort of trend is maintained. So population growth in Canada is actually remarkably rapid for a wealthy country. It's my conclusion that no other large animal, and in this context, a large animal is considered to be one weighing more than about 100 pounds, 44 kilograms, no other large animal has ever in the history of life on Earth managed to maintain such such a large abundance, such a large population as humans are maintaining today. And at the same time, no other large animal has probably been able to achieve such a cosmopolitan distribution. And of course, when you talk about population issues, it isn't just about we Homo sapiens. We're carrying a lot of other species that live, not a lot, but probably a few hundred species that live with us in mutualistic type relationships. We're tightly cooperating and to benefit each other's economy. And this kind of idea is supported by the notion that there's now more than a billion cows alive. Some 1.4 billion cows are alive in any particular year today. And one might ask yourself, well, how can that represent a mutualism when the cows in general are treated so awfully while they're being raised, when they're being slaughtered, and in other respects? It's a mutualism in an ecological sense just because there's so many of them. Their natural abundance might have been 5 or 10 million several thousands of years ago before they became domesticated and brought into cultivation. And now, like us, they're hugely, hugely populated, and they're responsible for a significant part of the aggregate environmental footprint of the global human economy. And 17 billion chickens and millions of hectares of wheat. These are other species that in some respects are also overpopulated in the sense of representing a type of an imbalance with the ability of the biosphere to support these species and their collective enterprise on a sustainable level. In fact, as we've seen in some of the presentations, it's probably reasonable to conclude that a human influence extends in one way or another throughout the biosphere, if only because you couldn't sample an organism anywhere on the planet and sample their fatty tissues and not find detectable residues of for example, anthropogenic organochlorines. Each one of us, any organism on the planet whose fatty tissues or lipids or fats we were to sample, would have detectable residues of DDT, dieldrin, PCBs, dioxins, and furans. Those residue levels would be small. They would be low. They don't necessarily represent a health risk, but they do represent part of the signature of people on the biosphere. And of course, much of the rest of the biosphere has been much more intensively domesticated than that. Now, the second major subject area in environmental science is that of natural resources. No other species than humans has ever managed to appropriate such a large fraction of the natural capital of the planet. By one account, by a team of ecologists, we're already utilizing more than half of the planet's productivity. That's both direct and indirect use. The Global Footprint Network suggests that the human economy is already exceeding the biocapacity of the planet and in the process accumulating large amounts of natural debt in the form of cumulative degradation of productivity, of the ability of landscapes and seascapes to provide nutrient flows and assimilate wastes and that sort of thing. That damage can be thought of as a type of immense natural debt, which is growing larger and larger every year. Now, of course, in basic resource ecology, resources that we use are of two fundamental types. The one type is non-renewable, which can only be mined. It's present in a finite quantity, and as we use those kinds of resources, we use them up. And then the other sort of resources are potentially renewable. They can regenerate after they're harvested. And of course, it's the renewable resources that are the only conceivable basis of a sustainable human economy. Now, of course, because non-renewables don't regenerate, they can't be used in a sustainable fashion. We can use them, but we use them up. There's less available for use in the future, less available for future generations. If we look at the structure of so-called advanced economies, like those of North America, Western Europe, Japan, Australasia, and increasingly so the BRIC companies, countries, Brazil, Russia, China, India, Indonesia, South Africa, rapidly growing economies. If you look at the structure of their economies, you find, of course, that they're based on a hugely enthusiastic consumption of fossil fuels and metals, non-renewable resources that are flowing through their economies in order to subsidize economic growth, which can't be maintained over the longer term. In Canada, for example, 76% of our energy production involves non-renewables, and we're a country that's relatively rich in renewable hydroelectric resources. In the United States, 94% of the energy production involves non-renewable natural resources, mostly fossil fuels, and to a substantial degree also nuclear. Those kinds of numbers aren't symptomatic of sustainability. If we look at the lifespan of global known reserves of petroleum, it's only about 54 years, and for natural gas, it's about 64 years. So those data are calculated based on the known economically exploitable stocks of petroleum or of natural resource divided by the recent rates of annual use. Dividing the stocks by the rate of use gives you the lifespan, and those numbers are alarmingly small, although surprisingly larger than they were only a couple of decades ago. And of course, the reason for that is we've been remarkably adept at finding additional exploitable stocks of these resources. But that's kind of good, and it extends the time available for our economy to transition into a more sustainable one. It still does not hide the fact that these resources are inherently non-renewable. Now, in Canada, the lifespan of the reserves of conventional petroleum are only about 15 years, and they're 12 years for natural gas. But around 15 years ago, the lifespan of petroleum in Canada made a big saltation. In 1 year, it more than tripled. And that's because the energy gurus of the world decided, well, the Canadian oil sand resources are now substantially exploitable. And in fact, at the time, there were several large developments, and there have been others subsequent to that since. If the active oil sand reserves, the ones that are actually in play right now, that are actually being extracted and used to develop synthetic petroleum, if those reserves are added to the lifespan of Canadian petroleum, we get up to a number of 28 years, and if we take all of the proven reserves, which under recent economic conditions are likely to be exploitable, then the petroleum resources of Canada develop a lifespan of 150 years, which is remarkably different from just a couple of decades ago. Nevertheless, these are renewable resources. They can't be they're non-renewable resources and can't be used in a sustainable fashion. Now, Canadians are amongst the wealthiest people in the world in terms of simple indicators like per capita GDP, per capita use of natural resources, per capita generation of wastes. We use about six times more energy on a per capita basis than people in those rapidly developing economies, and more than 40 times more energy on a per capita basis than people living in the poorest countries of the world. If you do a simple desktop calculation and multiply the Canadian population times the Canadian per capita GDP, or Canadian per capita use of energy as simple indicators of environmental impact, and you do those same calculations for India and China, you actually get similar numbers as a result, which tells us that the national economic and environmental impacts of Canada, India, and China are remarkably similar. And those kinds of calculations help us to understand that it isn't just India and Canada. India and China that are overpopulated countries, in some respects Canada is as well, because of our intense per capita environmental effect. So we have a highly desirable lifestyle in Canada, but it's intensive in terms of environmental impact, and it's mostly based on a rapid and non-sustainable flow of non-renewable resources. Sometimes this is referred to metaphorically as representing a type of affluenza, an affluent lifestyle that's actually a little bit pathological in an environmental context. Now, pardon me? It's highly well, everybody wants to have affluenza. Any person living in a poor country that you might be able to have a conversation with, possibly through an interpreter, they want to come to Canada and live just like us. So it's contagious in that sense. I've had those conversations many times, once in the highlands of New Guinea. In any event, renewable resources, of course, if they're used well, if they're used wisely, they're potentially renewable and sustainable. And we depend on renewable resources to provide us with all of our food, much of the material that we use, wood, natural textiles, certain types of biopolymers like celluloid, for example, was one of the first plastics ever to have been manufactured, and it was initially manufactured from wood pulp. Renewable resources also already supply us with considerable energy, mostly reflecting various kinds of physical manifestations of sunlight, which can involve direct solar, water flowing down gravitational gradients, photovoltaics, and even wind is a manifestation of solar energy. The only two kinds of renewable sources of energy that are available to us, at least that I know of, that aren't solar are what? Tidal and geothermal. So tidal energy is based on the attraction between Earth and its moon, and geothermal is energy produced. You all knew that. I just didn't give you enough time to think of the correct answer. In any event, renewable energies, while they are potentially sustainable, they're often used irresponsibly, and that results in their stocks being mined. When we do this, we're treating potentially renewable resources as if they were non-renewable resources and we use them up. And that's a remarkably irresponsible and callous thing to do, but it frequently happens, and we heard of many examples in previous presentations. The collapses of almost all major stocks of wild marine fishes, extensive degradation of agricultural land caused by salinization, desertification, and losses of tilth through degradation of organic matter. Increasingly widespread deforestation. Numbers I've read suggest that compared to 10,000 years ago, only about half of the global forest estate survives. And in the next half century or so, we might lose half of that surviving half. Again, that represents a huge loss of a potentially renewable natural resource. And then there are many collateral damages that are associated with those and other problems, such as global warming and the biodiversity crisis. Now, this shows an image of a big logging truck, and that's a big truck. The size and impressiveness of this vehicle isn't captured well in the photograph. In actual fact, The logging in this image, which was taken in a mid-altitude montane area of central Vancouver Island, in actual fact, the logging of this image is sustainable of the natural resource, because I know that there's going to be a secondary forest regenerating on these clear cuts. The regeneration will involve the same species, albeit probably in different relative mixes. In another 80 to 100 years, there's going to be relatively big trees to be harvested on those sites again. But I also know that in this particular case, old-growth forests were logged, and those old-growth forests will never regenerate because it takes 2 to 3 centuries for the old-growth condition to re-exert itself. Instead, a primary old-growth forest is converted into a highly productive secondary forest, but there's still a possibly permanent loss of an important natural value, that being old-growth forest condition. So the economic resource, it can actually be sustained in a situation like this, but the natural condition, which is a type of an ecological value that transcends human economic needs, isn't being maintained. It's being mined in this particular context. Now, the third major category in environmental science was various other environmental damages. The most important one in many respects, as far as I'm concerned, is that the environmental crisis includes a crisis of biodiversity, of indigenous biodiversity, the biodiversity is, that is locally evolved and appropriate to certain ecoregions of the planet. Many species are becoming extinct, and even larger numbers are becoming increasingly at risk of becoming extinct. According to E.O. Wilson, up to 20% of the species that exist today could be lost rather soon. And even entire natural ecosystems are endangered. In Canada, the most at-risk natural ecosystems would be Carolinian forest, tall grass prairie, and several types of dry coastal forests, such as dry Gary Oak-dominated ecosystems on southern Vancouver Island. Those ecosystems are critically endangered because they only survive today at a 1 or 2% of their original extent. And the many species that are dependent on those natural systems are, of course, also at risk. Now, by far the leading cause of this global crisis of biodiversity is the conversion of natural habitats into anthropogenic land uses. This problem is particularly severe in the tropics and in the subtropics. As a cause of loss of biodiversity, it's much less consequential in higher latitude countries in Canada, and that's an important reason why, especially with respect to biodiversity, Canada is not the Brazil of the North. Although we harvest in recent years 600,000 to 700,000 hectares of mostly primary forest per year in Canada, we're not causing a biodiversity crisis by doing that. In Brazil, there's huge losses of endemic species and local distinct ecosystem types, which are much more highly and strongly connected to damages to biodiversity. Now, while ecosystem conversions into anthropogenically land uses are by far the most important cause of the biodiversity crisis, there are other causes as well. Invasive aliens, which Tony Ricciardi talked about today in a Canadian context, are also important, as is over-harvesting of some species. But by far, the crisis is being caused by the destruction of natural habitats in tropical and subtropical latitudes. Now, pollution is also another important problem. I'm not going to talk about it in detail. It's something that I've specialized in during my career, but it does result in the degradation of natural resources that we need for our human economy. To some degree, it threatens natural ecosystems, and in some cases, it's a health risk to people. And then, of course, anthropogenic climate change is a threat to the economy and to the biosphere as a whole. We can think of anthropogenic climate change as being caused by emissions of greenhouse gases as types of non-toxic pollutants that affect planetary physiology. So, according to these sorts of evidence, and you're familiar with everything I've talked about so far and much, much more, we can characterize the present situation as representing an environmental crisis and one that's likely to become worse into the next several decades. And these kinds of synoptic statements, general statements, are essentially correct. Increases of the human population and of our key mutualist species are excessive. They're somewhat out of control, and they're not sufficiently related to the ability of the supporting ecosystems to maintain them at viable levels. Our non-sustainable economy is rapidly depleting resources that are needed by the present generation by our kids, by their kids, and so on, by future generations. Biodiversity is suffering awful damage. It's just terrible what's going on to the natural world, to the many other species with whom we are sharing the planet. Earth's physiology is being compromised, especially through anthropogenic warming, and not enough is yet being done to repair or avoid this kind of damage. It's not being done by politicians, by leaders of business and industry, or for that matter, by most citizens, by people like us. And this has resulted in a commonly expressed, but a kind of a repugnant metaphor for our species and its economy as it exists today. This is a metaphor that's commonly expressed by environmental specialists. It's like, what are humans like? Well, we're like a malignancy. We're like a metastatic cancer that's affecting the face of the earth. And that's not a very flattering metaphor, but in some respects, it's an accurate one. It reflects a type of a pathology. It reflects a type of damage that's progressive and potentially lethal. But it doesn't have to be lethal. As I was just so impressed that speaker after speaker today talked about their feelings that things could be repaired, that we already know what the fixes are. For a while, I kind of wondered, you know, do people really feel that way? And speaker after speaker today expressed hope and optimism. Well, hope. They expressed hope. And they all said that they know what the fixes are to the damages that they were talking about. It's just this tiny issue of implementation, of radical, even revolutionary change in society and economy in order to help the human enterprise achieve a more sustainable structure. So a core premise of ecological economics is that a sustainable human economy has to be based on the wise use of renewable resources, which means using them in ways that allow them to regenerate sufficiently so that their future stocks aren't being compromised, along with aggressive conservation of non-renewable natural resources. Although they will eventually be depleted, at least if we aggressively conserve them today, they'll be available to some degree to future generations to help them ease into the transition of heavier and heavier and eventually ultimate dependence on renewable natural resources to provide them with food, energy, and materials. Now, although the global economy is rapidly depleting stocks of both renewable and non-renewable resources, we know fixes to these issues and ways of moving the transition forward. Now, a problem with this conventional interpretation of sustainability, which focuses on the needs of people, is that potentially that kind of sustainable economy could be implemented across the entire surface of the planet, leaving hugely insufficient space for indigenous biodiversity. And that's why it's really better as ecologists and environmental specialists for us to think in terms of ecological sustainability. It's a loftier idea of what's necessary. It demands that even while humans implement a resource sustainable economy, they also ensure that conditions remain suitable for biodiversity to maintain itself at viable levels. And by biodiversity, I'm talking mostly about other species and the natural kinds of ecosystems that are characteristics of the various biogeographical realms of the planet. So we've got this notion of sustainability that includes biodiversity and other important problems, and we have the fix. We know what the cure for this human malignancy actually looks like. And it's knowing this fact that keeps me hopeful. I never start or finish an environmental class, and I've been teaching them for more than 3 decades now, without stating that although we're going to be talking about problems for all of the term, we're starting with hope and we're going to end with hope. There are lots of problems, but we know how to fix them, and it's up to all of us to make sure that those fixes get implemented. We do have time to make the necessary changes to avoid and repair most of the environmental damages. Extinctions, of course, can't be reversed, and that's why they represent such a grievous type of environmental damage. But many extinctions that might otherwise occur can yet be prevented, and many endangerments that presently exist can yet be repaired by building up the populations of those affected species. The enduring solutions towards sustainability require actions that are mass level. Everybody has to be involved. that are multi-generational. It's not like my generation is passing the responsibility to your generation. I'm still alive, and I still carry a great deal of responsibility, but I share it with all of you as we do with generations of people as yet unborn. The solutions are also multicultural and multinational. This has to be a global solution. The prudent actions that are necessary include developing and implementing sensible population policies. The key aspect of one is, of which is the emancipation of women to have free and ready access to safe and effective means of controlling their own reproduction. We also need a fast implementation of renewable energy and material strategies. We need assertive conservation of non-renewable resources and a viable conservation of biodiversity in all countries and across the world. Now, let me speak a little bit more about conserving biodiversity, not in a great deal of depth, but I've spent several decades as a volunteer with the Nature Conservancy of Canada. I've been on the board for that, the board of directors for that time, and I've also done ecological stuff for them, ranging down to site assessments and that sort of thing. I just published a history of the organization a couple of weeks ago. And the Nature Conservancy of Canada, you might know, is one of Canada's largest environmental NGOs. In recent years, it's had annual budgets ranging from about $70 to $120 million a year of conservation equity that's been achieved. And by working with the Nature Conservancy of Canada and also through my regular academic pursuits, I think I've gotten a little bit of a handle on the kinds of national level actions that are necessary to achieve a sustainable conservation of biodiversity in Canada. And basically two clusters of actions are necessary. The first one involves doing what we can to maintain reasonably high levels of biodiversity on the seascapes and landscapes where the human economy is working. This includes areas used for fishing, for forestry, for agriculture, and for urbanization, using softer management practices to the degree that's possible in order to support higher levels of biodiversity. Now, I don't know the McGill campus all that well. I haven't studied it like I have, say, the campus of my own university. I can tell you that at Dalhousie, I can stand in the greenest spots on the campus turn around, a pirouette, a 360-degree view of what I see and not see a single native plant. And that's because the conventional influence of horticulture is to favor alien species over natives. But I also know, because I've done it at my own home, that with relatively little expense, but a little bit of effort, that campus where I teach could be naturalized by planting native species in abundances and distributions that would achieve habitats that are relatively natural in a biogeographic sense. And if the plants are appropriately planted, there would be more native animals present as well. That could be done at McGill. It could be done in Montreal. It could be done in cities everywhere. I'm just using this as an example of things that could be done to soften the intensity of the human footprint in working landscapes and seascapes so that larger abundances of indigenous biodiversity can be supported. And in fact, if we don't do this, we'll lose a lot of biodiversity because it's unlikely that protected areas, the second major strategy, can do it all. It has to be an integration of effective actions in both working and protected landscapes. Now, protected areas are areas of land or of water that are set aside from intensive use in the human economy. Some economically important uses might still be allowed, like non-consumptive outdoor recreation, hiking, scientific research, nature study, that sort of thing. But those uses wouldn't be severe threats to the indigenous biodiversity, which are the bottom line for consideration for the establishment of protected areas. Now, a protected area network has to be properly designed in terms of the sizes and connections of the protected areas. An appropriate connected an appropriate network of protected areas has to be rapidly implemented, because each year our options are being decreased because increasingly natural habitats are being converted into anthropogenic uses. And then once created, these protective areas have to be stewarded properly. They have to be managed appropriately in terms of monitoring their condition in order to identify whether ecological problems might be arising. If you do find new problems, such as a novel invasive species, then research has to be undertaken to understand the causes and consequences of that recently monitored change. And then, once you understand that, you have to implement a management solution, which can range anywhere from eradication to other measures that will reduce the abundance of your ecological pathogens and increase the relative abundance of the native biodiversity values that you're trying to maintain. Now, this is expensive and extensive work. It has to be done by governments, particularly since they own or control so much of the land base. But there's also a role for environmental organizations like the Nature Conservancy and other land trusts. There's a role for the private sector, and there's a role for individuals. If you own a home, for example, with some green space, you can choose to naturalize that, which won't make any difference if you're the only person doing it. But if this becomes a widespread practice in your neighborhood, it's remarkable how much native biodiversity you'll start to see. My house is in downtown Halifax, and I've got what I consider to be an astonishing population of red-backed salamanders present in my front yard. And my front yard is sufficiently naturalized that I can take classes there for field trips, and all they have to do to see all of these native plants is cross the street from the campus at Dalhousie, and they'll see more than 100 indigenous plants that they won't be able to see on their own university campus. But they could if the horticultural practice became more natural in its intent. Now, there is a lot of good news. A lot of progress is being made. It isn't nearly enough. These are all terrific-looking indicators because they show a lot of growth. These are data for the Nature Conservancy of Canada, for example. This organization was 50 years old last year. For most of its history, it didn't do a lot of business, a few hundred thousand dollars a year. And then recently, it took off this peak year, which achieved a number of about $140 million, involved one project in southeastern British Columbia called Darkwoods, which was a 55,000-hectare purchase of private property, which is now set aside as a protected area. This is the property assets. Those are cumulative hectares of property that the Conservancy has actually retained title to and also has the stewardship responsibility for. This is the growth of the several investment funds that the Conservancy has. These are equivalent to university endowments in the sense that they give you a predictable annual cash flow that in this case is used mostly to fund stewardship. This is a comparable graph that shows the growth of protected areas in Canada. Those are mostly governmental protected areas. If you graphed the growth of private protected areas, such as those of the Nature Conservancy, you wouldn't even be able to see them. That's how important the governmental protected area system is in Canada, except in southern reaches of the country, where government owns a lot less land, and that's generally where the conservancies and land trusts tend to work. This is a graph that shows the ecoregions, mostly in southern Canada, where the threat to native biodiversity is most intense. That shows the ecoregions where the Conservancy has developed plans for conservation. The plans for conservation essentially identify the kinds of natural communities that are present, the species at risk that are vital in the ecoregion, and then they identify the locations of the most important habitats. And in order to identify those sites that either are already protected or that should be protected, and if they're in private publicly held, if they're privately owned properties, these become the strategic acquisition properties of the Nature Conservancy. But these results are shared with private companies, with governments, in order to encourage integrated conservation action. This planning process has cost millions of dollars for the Nature Conservancy, and you'll be astonished to know that that money was mostly obtained by an almost unknown environmentally beneficial action of the Harper government. Of all of the things I know of in the environmental realm that the Harper government has done, the one that I most heartily applaud, I mean, there's been a lot of damage, right? But 6 years ago, they gave the Nature Conservancy of Canada $225 million. Now, this was to set up a fund that was used to help with the purchase of private lands, but also to engage in these conservation planning projects, which will be of benefit all across southern Canada. That $225 million, $25 million of that went to Ducks Unlimited Canada, and they also did property acquisitions using rules of conservation need and prioritization that were similar to those used by the Nature Conservancy. $15 million went to smaller land trusts across the country, and they did their projects in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy. And then the Conservancy had the largest share of $185 million to do its own business. And although remarkably, the Government of Canada really didn't have any performance metrics that demanded of the Conservancy, the Conservancy pledged to manage the federal monies on a 2-to-1 basis, and when the program finished about 6 months ago, they'd matched almost on a 3-to-1 basis. So this is a relatively effective way to spend conservation dollars. Okay. The point being made here is that a lot of progress has been made in conserving natural habitats in Canada, but there's an enormously large amount yet to be done. So we've learned about an environmental crisis and its biodiversity crisis, and we've learned that we know about the fixes. It's just a matter of implementing them by making the right kinds of choices. And if we make those choices, we can leave the world, the ecological world, in a better place than it might otherwise be. In other words, if those choices weren't to be made. So there is hope. We've heard it from all of the speakers, and I hope that everybody takes that message home today. There is hope because we know the way forward. It's just a matter of convincing society at large and its big-time decision makers to make the right choices on our behalf, but also to make the right choices as individuals. Now, as environmental specialists and learners, we all have particular leadership roles to play. Each of us as individuals have to strive to work harder and more effectively towards moving our society to this goal of ecological sustainability. And I expect we'll all do that. We'll do it honestly. But will our society as a whole achieve what's necessary? Do we have enough compassion for the needs of future generations and for other species in the natural world in general? Do we have the collective vision and strength of character that's needed to seize the environmental challenges that we face? Will the right choices be made, or will apathy and contrariness prevail? Will we go right towards the cheap burgers and a non-sustainable but fun and affluent lifestyle, or will we go left towards truth, justice, wisdom, and of course, ecological sustainability? Those are the kinds of choices that we have in front of us. So, are we humans? Me, you, and those of us yet to come. Are we just a malignant force on the only planet in the universe that's known to sustain life and ecosystems? Or can we learn to live in a harmonious relationship with natural resources, other species, and natural ecosystems? Well, of course, the answer to that question can only be no. And the answer to this question can only be yes. And have hope that we can get there, while also recognizing the hard truths that it won't be an easy slog. It's a great deal of work. It involves enormous economic restructuring that are essentially revolutionary in their scope, but they can and must be done. Those changes are necessary, and if we do them, they'll get us to this happy place of an ecologically sustainable human economy. Thank you.